You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to The Profile podcast. God calls us to use our influence to share his love and goodness. For some, this is in leadership. I'm Andy Peck, and for the past 19 years, I've been interviewing Christians to find out how to lead better. Taking the initiative isn't always easy, so I hope you'll benefit from this latest conversation. The Profile podcast is brought to you by Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe today and get full online access and the print magazine every month at premierchristianity.com. Few Christian leaders can get away without having some kind of measurement of progress. Depending on your line of work, this might be items sold, profit made, supporters found, or money raised. Inevitably, the church leader has a number of possible metrics, the major one being church attendance. How many show up, and how does this compare year on year, and how does it compare with other churches in the area and in the denomination or church stream you're part of? If you Google the average UK church size, you will get a variety of figures, depending on your denomination or church stream, anything from 54 to 129. In this show, we want to focus upon small churches, and in particular, churches that remain small. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show by Carl Vaters. Carl has served in small church ministry for over 40 years in the United States, currently based in Fountain Valley, California, and specifically in Orange County, and thus close to some of the largest churches in the United States. He's a sought-after speaker, attending conferences explaining the value of small churches and how to lead them well. He produces resources for helping small churches thrive at carlvaters.com and is the author of 5 books on church leadership, including his newest, Desizing the Church, How Church Growth Became a Science, Then an Obsession, and What's Next. So lovely to have you on the show, Carl. I understand you've known times of church growth and indeed of decline, and that kind of led you into this particular ministry.
I have, and it did. As you mentioned, I live in Orange County, California, so I am in one of the 4 or 5 pockets in the world that can maybe carry the title Mega Church Central. yes. I live, less than 2 kilometers from the original Calvary Chapel. Just a little further away from that is Vineyard Church, Crystal Cathedral, Saddleback Church, Church on the Way, Angelus Temple. These are not just large churches, but they're places where large church movements have begun, and they are a very easy drive from my front door. So I'm in a place where big seems inevitable, but as I've discovered in my 32 years of ministry here, it's not as inevitable as it seems.
You came to a church that was really very small, I believe.
I did, yeah. 32 years ago, I came to a church that had been through 5 pastors in the previous 10 years. And as you know, when you're changing pastors that quickly, it's really hard to maintain anything. So when I showed up, they had come really close to taking a vote to close the church. And they thought, let's bring in one more pastor. And if that doesn't work, then we probably will close the church. And okay. I was that pastor.
No pressure.
So that's what I can. Yeah, exactly. thankfully, they didn't tell me that at the time. I found that out later after things got better. So they were wise enough not to let me know that. And I came to a church that had 20 discouraged seniors, and in a very small building. Like if you want to sit in the back row, there's only 4 rows in front of you. But we're on a really main street. The street we are on is one of the main streets that borders Disneyland, 12 kilometers to the north of us. So tens of thousands of people drive right by our front door every day. And we look around and we see all these other big world-class churches. And so I thought, this is the place where church growth is going to happen. It happened for a short period of time. We got up to about 200. It took about 15 years to get to about 200 people. And then in 2 years, it went from 200 to 400. And I thought, oh man, we're really going now. Everything's clicking. The principles are working. And then faster that went up, it collapsed to under 100. And I was left with my head spinning. And I really had to recalibrate and re-understand what it was that God was sending me there to do.
Right. Your thinking process led you to write, and that led you, other people, to notice what you were writing and to
spark things off to the ministry that you're heading up now?
Yeah, it did. So I found myself in this place where, you know, all of the numerical increase that we had worked so hard for a decade and a half seemed to be gone overnight. And there had been no scandal. There had been no split. I went to experts. I went to people all around and asked, what do you think happened? How can you assess it? Nobody could put their finger on it. They'd come to the church and they'd go, there's no reason this church shouldn't be huge. That things are great here. This is a wonderful, healthy, strong, vibrant church. This doesn't make any sense, because at the time, and still today in most church growth circles, the belief is that if a church becomes healthy, numerical growth is inevitable. And I have since come to discover, starting with my own experience, that you can have health and not have the constant numerical increase. Numerical increase is not inevitable. I now call it the myth of inevitability. You can be healthy and not get bigger. And in fact, as I've done the research and as I've traveled now around the U.S. and around the world, including in the U.K., I have found that there are a lot of really healthy churches that do not continue to constantly get bigger, but most end up finding what I have since come now to call a shoe size. Right? When I was younger, all of my body grew, and there's a certain point where my feet and everything else stopped growing. And the fact that I, you know, have a certain shoe size, nobody with a bigger shoe size with any, you know, sanity looks at that and goes, well, I'm better than you because I got a bigger shoe size. That's just not how it works. And so I think a lot of churches find their shoe size, if not permanently, but certainly for seasons, where this, at this size right now, is where God has put us, and this is where we work the best. So let's do the best job we can at the size that we currently are.
Well, thank you, Carl, because I was going to ask you about, I think, a sentence or two in The Purpose-Driven Church by Rick Warren, of course, who's planted what Saddleback ended up in Orange County. Of course, it moved along a number of places during its existence, but it's in its 20,000-30,000 or so strong. And I think Rick said, if your church is healthy, then it's going to grow, just like a child will grow if they're being fed appropriately. You're saying no. So what would be, if someone is trying to evaluate their small church, what are the sort of factors that they need to consider? Because of course there could be some, a church could be newly planted or whatever. There could be so many reasons why a church is small at any given moment, couldn't there?
Right. Yeah. Let me get to that. But first of all, let me address that quote from Rick Warren. He's very close by here. I've never met him, but I have a great admiration for him. And I do agree that when a church is healthy, it will grow, but not all growth is going to happen with the people sitting in front of me on a Sunday morning. There are all kinds of ways that churches grow. They can become a sending church. They can become a teaching church. And you want to grow in depth more than you want to grow in numbers. So there's all kinds of different ways that churches grow. Our church, for instance, while we've kind of steadied out at 150 to 200 as a typical size for us, which is on the high end of small, we are a sending church. And as I travel again now, I'm no longer pastoring the church, but now I pastor pastors. And as I travel around all over the country and around the world, almost everywhere we go, I run into people that our church sent off into ministry. So we are constantly contributing to the growth of the church, even though the size of our church hasn't changed much over the last 20 years. So the question is, where do you want the growth to occur? If for a lot of churches, I'm convinced that we are called to kingdom growth that won't necessarily increase the numbers in our building week after week.
Okay.
For one of the reasons for us is we live in a very transitional place. It is four to 5 years or so is typically about how long people live near us. Plus, we have a lot of college students. So in 4 years, they're gone. We've got maybe 25 to 30% of our congregation typically is college students. So you're going to lose them every 4 years, plus others as they transition up and out for all kinds of different reasons. So yes, growth will happen, but it doesn't inevitably mean that it's going to happen with the numbers of people that are sitting in the pews on Sunday morning. So that was the original. Now that I've done that, I've forgotten the question that you were leading to with that. If you could be
Asking really the question that context is, you know, if someone's just planted a church, and obviously it might start small, but there can be other factors that can lead to a church not growing. And I guess from a leadership angle, someone like yourself joins a church that's small and says, well, there needs to be changes here in order for things to develop and grow. And I was just wondering what kind of factors you look for or you talk about as inhibiting growth in those kind of settings.
If you were to read through the Bible for the first time, and if you could somehow have a neutral approach to it, nobody can approach anything neutrally, we all bring our baggage, but if you could, you would not get to the end of the Bible, close the last page and go, oh, it's about getting more people in the room. That's what Jesus was after, right? So we can put that into the text, but it doesn't come naturally from the text, right? So what does come from the text, however, are all kinds of other things, and they're not numerically quantifiable. So worship, are we worshiping? Are we becoming a more worshipful church? Are we a friendly church? Are we an inviting church? Is this a place where people are meeting the needs of their community? When you look at your congregation, do the demographics of your congregation look like your neighborhood used to look? Or do the demographics of your congregation look like your neighborhood currently looks?
Right.
There's a lot of churches that look like their neighborhood used to look back when the church was in its heyday, but doesn't so much now. Tom Rainer is an American church consultant, and when he and his team go into a church, one of the first questions they ask is, what year is it here? Right. And for a lot of congregations, it's 10, 20, 30, or 40 years ago instead of it's 2025. So there are all of these factors and that you can get from the text. When you take a look, for instance, at the New Testament letters to churches, when you take a look at the seven messages to the seven churches of Revelation, for instance, you will never see praise because of size or criticism because of smallness. But yes, you will see praise because of worshipfulness, because of endurance, because of patience, because of integrity, and you will see criticism because of arrogance and because of pride and because of adultery and because of, right? The size doesn't factor into whether or not they're being praised or criticized. And in fact, when you look at the seven books in Revelation, the ones that receive the greatest praise are the small, struggling ones, and the ones that receive the greatest criticisms are the ones who are bigger and prouder. So we've got to really be careful about this.
That's a fascinating. In fact, I guess other than Jesus talking about 12 apostles and sending out the 70 and the number that were in the upper room in Acts, 120, numbers are almost absent, aren't they? We haven't got a clue of the size of any of the New Testament churches, other than they were probably in a large home and maybe, you know.
I mean, the most cited one is that there were, you know, 3,000 souls added to the church on the day of Pentecost.
Right, indeed, yeah.
Right, and I've heard that from church, my friends in the church growth, and I say friends and I mean it, friends in the church growth movement, who will say, well, that's a mega church right there. So day one, we had a mega church, to which my response is, yeah, but in the context of that passage, and you can't just take the number, you got to take the passage. Mm. That's just basic exegesis. You got to take the entire passage.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that passage, it names 16 language groups or people groups that were there visiting because it was the festival of Pentecost. Jewish people had come from all over the country and other countries. And presumably, they went back home afterward. So you had 16 exterior plus the Jerusalem Jews. So you had 17 language groups or people groups represented among that 3,000. And then it doesn't say, then it says after that, they met daily in the temple courts and house to house. So it appears that they continued to come back to the temple courts where almost certainly the day of Pentecost happened. A lot of us have this idea that it happened in the upper room. I don't know of an upper room that fits 3,000 people. plus, again, the festival of Pentecost, they would have all been in the temple courts every day. So that's where the day of Pentecost happened. So they continued to gather those that stayed in Jerusalem, but their main church services happened house to house, and that is the model for the rest of the New Testament.
Yeah. That's really helpful, Carl, and I hope will be of enormous encouragement to some who are, you know, battling away maybe and feel a little bit intimidated by larger churches in their town or city. But I guess church leaders also need to ask the question, but what might be some inhibiting factors within our congregation that means that maybe we're not growing when we ought to be growing and would like to grow?
Yeah, there are so many of them. One of the things that I run in most frequently is, and this is something that that me and my church growth friends completely agree on, and that is the pushback against any kind of change whatsoever. We want to stay exactly the way we are. So a church that refuses to change is often one sign of ill health, because the gospel is about transformation, and it's not about a single one-time transformation only. It is about daily becoming more and more like the image of Christ, and that means constant transformation. Also, if we are reaching people, while the average numbers may not increase regularly, there should be an infusion of new converts, even if they're replacing the folks who are leaving, like in our church, because they're graduating from college or because they're moving on somewhere else. There should be an infusion of new converts as well, and that's going to constantly change the look and the feel of the church. So that's the main one that I see, is this resistance to change, where we lock on to traditions, or we lock on to, and by traditions, I mean extra biblical traditions, or we lock on to a physical building, and that becomes the main thing that we do, rather than, okay, the things we want to lock on to are the essentials of the gospel. Are we worshiping Jesus? Are we ministering to our community? Are we acting as people of integrity? Are we discipling believers? Are we sending them off in evangelism? If we're doing that, and it doesn't look different every 5 to 10 years at minimum, then we're probably locked more into our own traditions than we are into biblical principles.
Yeah. Now, that's helpful. And we've had conversations on this show about change management, and I'd encourage listeners to go through those, because that's a whole other conversation. Carl, in some denominations, certainly in the UK and church streams, there's a philosophy that says we want our church to remain smallish. So maybe they get to 100, 120, and then they, as a philosophy, will say, right, we will plant another church at that point. So they're never going to become a mega church, even if it was revival broke out. There would be, you know, they'd rather have 20 smaller churches than one very large, mega church or whatever. Any thoughts on that philosophy? Is that something you're familiar with?
I am, and I have a great appreciation for that. One of the things, you know, I've been in ministry long enough that I've seen some seasons come and go. And one of the real positives about the season that we're in right now in the church is that there's more openness to different approaches than there used to be. When I was younger, if somebody came up with a new way of doing church, it became the way everybody should do church. It was a one-size-fits-all, particularly within a denomination. But now we understand that there are varying approaches in varying places. And one of them is that there are many that do limit it and say a lot of them will take it from John Wesley's lead, or from scientific understanding of relationships, where beyond 150, we can't really know each other very well. Whatever your reason is, they'll say, okay, once we do that, then we'll start a new church, a new body. There's also the multi-site movement that has a slightly different approach to that, but similar. I've done consultations at multi-sites, for instance, and one multi-site where I did a consultation, their philosophy is that they want one service every Sunday morning per 100 people. So when I was consulting with them, they were running 1,400 people. They had 7 different venues with 2 sites per venue. So 1,400 people means 14 different services.
Wow.
So the average service somebody's sitting in has on average 100 people, one as small as 40, one just over 300. But on average, you're sitting in a room with 100 people, and that's by design.
Right. And that's to facilitate relationship within the group that are participating in the service.
Yeah. And on each of those sites, for instance, they have a local campus pastor who knows the people at that site. So a lot of the folks who are attending that church, they know technically probably that they're a part of a church of 1,400, but that's not really their church. Their church is the 75 to 100 to 150 people that I'm sitting with in this service on this particular Sunday morning every week.
Yeah. Carl, as we reflect on this topic, there'll doubtless be some church leaders listening who have faced what you suggested. They know that their church is not keen to grow, and they feel still called to that group of people, but they may be frustrated. And I just wonder if what you would say to people who know that they're stuck because there are some endemic problems within the church, but there's not much they feel that they can do about it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I faced 32 years ago when I came to our congregation. You know, five pastors in 10 years, and they were like, one more pastor, you know, we're bringing in one more pastor, but if you change too much too fast, we're just not going to be able to handle it. So I realized, first of all, that I had to go fairly slow, but that I had to be consistent and persistent. So my philosophy was, I'm going to outlive you and I'm going to outlove you. I'm just going to keep going. We're going to disciple people. We're going to do ministry. I'm going to make a whole bunch of mistakes. And every time I make a mistake, we're going to forgive each other and we're going to continue to go. When problems have become habitual, and when stasis has become rigid and a church feels like it doesn't want to move, there are no quick answers to turn around. The only way to do it quickly is basically to melt down that church and start a new one. So I've seen pastors who go in and they're just blasting away. And in some situations, that's appropriate. Like the church has gone beyond the point of retrieval. And so you're going to use the building and you might even keep the name, but basically you're tearing it down to the studs and you're starting a brand new church again there. But in most places, if you're called to that church to actually revitalize that existing congregation, you have to know it will be a very, very slow process. And you're going to have to do it by outloving them and outliving them. You're just going to have to be patient and walk through them. And every once in a while, you're going to have to make decisions that are going to go against some of the, maybe even the power brokers and certainly some of the noisemakers in the church. And you're just going to have to say this, if you know that this is God, you're going to have to move ahead. Now, I'm very slow to say that because I'm actually the guy who sits down and says, let's get everybody in the room. I want to hear everybody. I don't want anybody to feel like they haven't been heard, even if they're not being followed. So, and the smaller the group is, the more important it is for people to at least say, well, at least he gave me a decent hearing before he did something that I didn't like. We can't say that we didn't at least have the conversation, and I can't say that I'm not being listened to. And the smaller the group is, the more important that is.
Carl, we've time's defeated us, but it's just time to talk a little bit about the resources you offer so that people who like what you're saying can go to your website and find out more. Remind us the kind of things that you have.
Sure. Yeah. As you mentioned, I've written five different books on church revitalization. The first four are specifically for small church pastors. The most recent one, which you mentioned, Desizing the Church, is for the entire church leadership world about how we got into this place where we become so obsessed with bigness. I also have a podcast called The Church Lobby. It comes out every 2 weeks, in which I interview different church leaders about issues that are particularly important to pastors and specifically to small churches. I travel and speak around the country and around my country and around the world to different conferences, both for church leadership and for denominational conferences. So if anybody is looking to have a speaker at any event that they've got going, I'd love to be able to talk to you. I'll be traveling to Europe later this year, not scheduled to be in the UK yet, but I will be in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. So if anybody in the UK would like to have me come over right after I'm there, I'd love to swing through Heathrow and come by wherever you are on my way home.
Wow, that sounds like a lovely offer. Do you know which month you're talking, Carl?
That's going to be October, November of 2025.
Oh, fabulous. Good stuff. Well, there's an offer for anyone listening. Splendid. Hey, it's we've just scratched the surface, but you've whetted our appetite and said some really refreshing stuff for those who are leading small churches. And I trust this will galvanize many to keep plugging away with what God's calling them to do. So thank you so much, Carl.
Thank you, Andy.
That was my chat with Carl Vaters, whose ministry can be found at carlvaters.com. That's Carl, K-A-R-L-V-A-T-E-R-S.com. And you can find some of the books and resources there if that is of particular interest, I hope. Our conversation was stimulating to you as you assess and evaluate where God has called you to be. And especially if it's in a small church, maybe your calling is indeed to be the size it is. And maybe you've been evaluating the numbers attending every week and not thought about the ongoing ministry that you provide as you maybe send people out or as you provide a particular kind of ministry within your community. Or maybe indeed you're small because you're stuck and it's time to have those conversations about why change has not taken place or why growth has not come. And, you know, outlove them and outlive them was Carl's suggestion. So maybe that's something you can consider. As always, you can find archived versions of The Leadership Show. You go to Premier Plus, the app or the website. You can also go to the podcast provider where you receive your podcasts, Apple, Podbean or Spotify, and type in The Leadership Show or its previous name, The Leadership File, and find many hundreds of former shows on various topics, including ones on change management. And if that's piqued your interest by our conversation, maybe you want to listen to the conversation I had on that particular topic. If you want to ponder facilitating change in the months ahead. So this is Andy Pack, thanking you for your company and looking forward very much to the next time. Bye for now.
The Leadership Show with Andy Peck. To get in touch, email andy.peck@premier.org.uk.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.